The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
We'll just proceed. So this is where we ended, and I didn't say too much about this because you all wrote about it in your homework. I want to talk a little bit about Tinbergen's experiment on landmark orientation of the female digger wasp, and the text says a little bit about it in Tinbergen's book, Curious Naturalists. There's a chapter that I put on the web as supplementary reading on the Stellar site, and these pictures were, except for this first one, are from that article. The first one is from an earlier chapter in the book where he talks about another species of wasp, another sand wasp, living in the same area of Holland. Okay? But this wasp is the bee eater. It hunts and kills bees. The sand wasp that he talks about later in the book, the article I posted, is a wasp that hunts caterpillars. A specific kind of caterpillar. And the problem here is, how does the wasp, which goes on these foraging trips looking for the key stimuli provided by the prey, in this case of this one, the bee, he gets the bee, there's a wasp flying with a bee, almost as big as he is, and he's got to find his way home. How does he do it? And this was one of the first experiments Tinbergen ever did as a young person. He knew the nest was here. So he got the bee used to having pine cones around that nest. He put the pine cones there. The bee got used to them. And then the bee left on his foraging, the wasp left on his foraging trip, captured a bee and came back. He had moved the pine cones, as you see here, and the wasp went to the center of the pine cones because he was using the visual landmarks. Okay? These are experiments he did on the other species, the sand wasp that eats caterpillars. He has the same problem. He goes far enough away from his nest that he wonders how can he find his nest in sand where there's not that many landmarks. He has to figure out, I mean, it's not obvious exactly where the nest is. So in this case, the nest, I've marked it just to make it obvious for you, but it's in that article. The nest was here, and he tried capturing the bee. They capture these bees. It's a common method in experimental ethology using field experiments to mark the animal. They use little colored paint or nail polish, something that doesn't harm the animal. And they were capturing the bees and moving them to where you see the X. So if he moved them over here, the bee would fly up and immediately go to his nest. And similarly here, here, and here. In this case, he didn't fly immediately. He flew over this way like he had lost his way, but then suddenly he changed and came back. Okay? So what do you think is happening? Well, if he moved a little bit further, he started flying in the wrong direction. And you can see for all of these, he flew in the wrong direction. For this one, he started doing what looks like a searching behavior, still didn't find his way back. This one, he went in the wrong direction initially, but then eventually found his way. Various experiments like that showed that he's using specific visual landmarks to find his way back, and to be sure of that, he did other experiments. In this one, the nest was here, and the bee was released here, and you can see he found its way directly. Now, what these dots are is artificial trees, little things that they stuck in the sand. Okay, so he created his visual landmark. And he wanted to do that so he could do experiments. He could move all the trees where the circles are. He put them in about the same pattern, released the bee here, and you can see the bee followed the tree line. Then he comes and then he starts flying around. Because, and even though he got very, he flew over to near where the nest was, he still wasn't sure. He flew back here, and finally he found his way to the nest. In this case, he did it over here. The animal wasn't even successful finding the nest. They moved the trees back, immediately, which was an important control. He immediately found the nest. Okay. Now, one other thing about these sand wasps that I wanted to call your attention to, I didn't ask you, I don't think I asked a specific question about it, about how the behavior patterns serve to differentiate two species of sand wasp that had not been separated by the morphological characteristics. They were all called Haemophila campestris, and they were being studied by Tinbergen. Earlier they had been studied by Behrens and Adriaanse, a Dutchman. I think Behrens is also Dutch, I can't remember. And they noticed, the Behrens noticed that there were the publications of Adriaanse on the same, what he thought was the same wasp, differed from his observations. So this is a comparison that Tinberg has written out about differences in the two reports. They both feed their larvae with larvae of another species, in one case sawflies, but the other one with this caterpillar. Okay, so they feed with different things. One of them has only one nest at a time, but the sand wasps, the same one that Tinbergen was studied, took care of multiple nests at the same time, which is why Tinbergen was so interested, because studying the capabilities of that wasp to do that. They had slightly different breeding periods, and then they had a different way of closing the nest. With the way they, what kind of sand they used, and what they did with the sand when they uncovered the nest. One of them put the sand back in one specific spot they called the quarry. The other just scattered it around the nest. Of course, they don't want to pile up the sand, make the position of the nest obvious, because then their larvae would be more subject to predators. Okay, so it's important to keep the nest hidden except to them. So then what happened was they sent, based on the behavioral work, they caught, I can't remember now if it was Tinbergen who did this or if it was Behrens, but they sent the adult wasps to the guy who had done the morphological characterization, and he studied them again, and he found small morphological differences that he hadn't paid any attention to before. They just assumed they were the same species. But once the behavior work had been done, then it became clear that they were slightly different. They were very different in behavior, so they don't, in fact, breed with each other. There's now two species of Haemophila. One was named after Adriaanse, who had done some of the behavioral work. But Behrens didn't get a species named after him. They kept the original name because that's the name he'd used, even though he was the one that called attention to all this. So it just verifies what Lawrence had made a big point of, that the behavioral characteristics are a key to identifying stimuli as much as morphological characteristics. Yes?
Back to the landmark orientation, do the animals get granted when the environment changes, like if it snows or if there's a...
Yes, they certainly would. They certainly would. In this case, if the season has changed, then they don't need to, because this is all happening within the breeding and nesting period. So it wouldn't matter. They don't keep them from season to season. There are species, though, that keep them. They'll come back to the same place year after year. So then they have to have clues that get them back to the right place that don't aren't changing, like on the beach. Yeah. Okay. Okay, this is a little bit different. It's another problem in navigation. It refers to hatchling sea turtles. Many of you have probably seen films and read about the sea turtles. These are turtles that the mother turtle lays her eggs up the beach, way below the sand. When they hatch, she's not there. Okay? So they come out, they're little wet things that are going to dry out in the sun if they don't get to the ocean pretty fast. So what do? Very much like the response of adult frogs, if the frog is not in the water, he's off the water, something scares him, he always heads for where the blue light is, where the most light is, and it's generally blue light. Why is that? Because that's where the lake is. You know, the trees are surrounding the lake. There's going to be less light there. The light is totally different towards the lake, and he's generally not very far. So it's almost always successful. He just heads toward the light. And similarly, the turtle, he heads for the brightest light. And they found that it is blue light that he prefers. So what is photopollution? Why does it disturb these little turtles? Somebody? Yeah.
If the brightest light is not where the ocean is, then it's still where the turtle will go to. So they'll go to the supermarket across the street, or they'll go to somebody's...
Exactly. They might end up in the supermarket parking lot where they're going to be squished, or they'll be outside so long they're going to dry out. We call that photopollution. It's created by humans, of course, creating abnormal lighting close to where these turtles are hatching. So I'm asking for two methods that people can use to improve the survival of those turtles, which are in some case endangered species. Somebody else read this? Yeah.
Turn off your lights or shield them?
They generally won't turn them off because they're often advertising lights or something like that.
Yeah, shield the lights or use different wavelengths.
Okay, different wavelengths. That's one way you can do. Because... What wavelength would you change to?
Oh, yellow.
Something in the yellow range instead of blue, and then they won't be so disturbed. And then what was the other thing? If you make it intermittent, they won't be as attracted. That's right. So even if you don't use yellow light, if it's an advertising thing, you can often make it more attractive to people if you make it blink or change. Yes?
Leatherback sea turtles, and we would actually dig up nests and move them to our enclosure so that we could be sure that they wouldn't have to deal with any sort of photo pollution. And we actually did not even have electricity at our camp, and we had flashlights. But
these are endangered sea turtles.
Yeah.
So they actually move the nests to put them in a safer place.
Basically, we just had to get used to working by moonlight because we couldn't
make those girls. Right. Very interesting story. That was in Costa Rica. Okay. Okay. More on navigation. The concept of dead reckoning. It's a commonly used phrase, and people think it just means very accurate navigational skills, but it actually means deduced reckoning. That's what the derivation of the term is. It's DED actually, for deduced reckoning. So, for example, if I close my eyes and walk to a different part of the room, you know, Or if you turn the light out, I could go to another part of the room and probably find my way back here, you know, with no visual cues at all. Now, what would I be doing to do that? A number of mammals can do this, including rats. They're using internal cues, okay, like vestibular cues. And even if we're being moved by somebody, if it's clear enough how we're being turned and so forth, we can still remember quite a bit of that. I mean, obviously, if it gets too complicated, we'll get lost. Okay. How are ants different? There's different ants, and there were different examples used in the book on page 80 there. We talked about desert ants. I don't know if I put any of this in here or not. Yeah, I did. So the internal cues versus the external cues used by various animals, especially these insects. They'll use, for example, the desert ant uses sun position. First they figured out they're using something in the global environment, and then they figured out he's actually using the position of the sun. So I'm asking, if you use the position of the sun, what'll happen if you put a bushel over him and let him go 3 hours later or 2 hours later and the sun has moved? What happens? Yeah? Sorry? He'll act like he still knows, even though the sun's moved. How? How do they do that? It's not only ants that do this. Many insects can do this, or birds that do this. If you're going to use the sun, you better use something else too, yes? They reset the position of the sun automatically with their internal clock. Bees are well known for this. Bees, foraging bees, they don't actually use the position of the sun. They use the angle of polarization of the light. They don't need to see the sun, but they do need a patch of blue sky because they use polarized light. We are not sensitive to the polarity of light, okay? So we buy polarized sunglasses to cut out the glare because glare off the road is polarized. Well, the light coming from the sky actually is polarized too. And you can check that with the polarized lenses actually. And these ants use the sun position and they correct for the movement. Another ant, there's two species of wood ant mentioned there in the text. The first he talks about also uses visual landmarks, but specifically features along the skyline. And it reminded me of some studies that I had done, and a German named Brotzler had done on Syrian hamster use of what appears to be skyline cues, visual cues. A hamster is an animal like these ants and bees that has to go out foraging. And he can stay out for some time because he can carry quite a bit of food back because he's got cheek pouches. So when he goes out, he looks slender. When he comes back, he looks pretty fat in the mouth, in the hole, his head and behind where his cheek pouches are located. And the only time they will depend on olfaction for getting back is if there are no visual cues to use. It's totally dark. If it's not dark, they will tend to use visual patterns. It's one of the uses of visual cortex in these animals, that they can detect and discriminate visual patterns. It's not always clear, how these animals that are so dependent on somatic sensation and olfaction are actually using vision. But for hamsters, they're visual enough, they use it for a number of things, including to find their way back home. And these ants do too. Another wood ant they studied is use of large objects where he could judge the distance he had to be from that object just by the angle to the top of the, from where he was to the top of the building, or they could be trees, okay? So they use vision to judge distances. So I'm just asking you a question there. How do mammals and birds judge distances? This is from your 935 class. How do we judge distances? We could do it like the ants, actually. But we have other means, too. That would depend on how far we are from something. If I throw her a ball, I could throw it to her accurately. I could probably throw a ball pretty accurately to any of you in the room. That means I have to be judging distance pretty carefully. How do I do it? Somebody? Yes? How do I judge that depth? I've got depth perception, yes, but to do that, I've got to have specific cues. Well, it depends on how far away we are. And monkeys have to be able to do this too in their foraging, grabbing fruit, leaping in the trees. And for them, it's more critical than it would be for me throwing the ball, because if they miss the tree limb, they might fall to their death, you know? But they have to be able to judge accurately. So we've evolved multiple cues. What are they? Size of the retinal image is one, but that, of course, you've got to know how big the object is, and it has been studied. They know that size alone can make a big difference for some animals. But what more specific cues are used to judge distance? Akua?
Binocular disparity
is one, that the image from our two eyes is slightly different in the two eyes. And we have neurons in the visual cortex that are tuned to those disparities. It doesn't work, though, if the object is very far away. But for a human or a monkey in a tree feeding on fruit, and yeah, we probably did that. We still can do it. Okay, we can judge distance pretty accurately if it's nearby. Okay? But I have pretty good depth perception, and I don't have disparity detection. I probably was born with it, but I don't have it now because of a suppression of vision in one eye when I was little. And I lost the disparity, the small disparity. I still have large disparities. It was tested in Richard Held's lab here at MIT. Nobody would believe me until I finally got it tested. Okay, and I also have motion disparity. The man who discovered this use of disparity cues, Veli Ulish, was at MIT for a while, and he was looking for subjects, and I came in, and I put on the red-green goggles that they used to test disparity. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Red on one side, green on the other, with a pattern of dots that are red and green. And so the only way you can see the pattern in depth, in fact, many of them, the only way you can see any pattern at all is to be able to use that disparity information. And then you see two things at different depths. And I would put the glasses on, I'd see nothing. I would just see the green, red and green dots. I don't see any depth at all. And so I told him, I said, but Dr. Ulish, if I go to a 3D movie and put on the lenses, I can watch the movie and I see the depth. And you know, he got angry. That's what sometimes scientists do when you don't fit their theory. It was a good lesson for me as a young experimental psychologist. But I didn't let him change my mind because I know what I experience. I turned out to be correct because I had lost. What he didn't know is how this was done in the brain, and that these could be lost with early experience, that they're shaped by early experience. What other things besides disparity do we use? We use the amount of vergence. If I if I do this, you know, many doctors do this, I bring it closer and closer, you can see my eyes moving. I actually use that information, the angle of my two eyes relative to each other, to judge depth. Again, it only works if things are pretty close. Okay? What other thing do we use? At least one more. Come on, you guys, you study perception. Course 9 people should all know that. Depth perception, come on. Look, I'm looking with one eye. I told you I don't have disparity detection. I have virgins, but I can tell the difference between him and her in the back. I'm certainly not using virgin's information for that. It's almost the same. And I can close my eyes and still do it. How am I doing it? Give me two ways. One thing is I'm moving. Even this way, what happens? He moves differently than she does. Try it. Close your eyes. Look, and now move your head. Near things move differently than far things. And you might not realize it, but we use that information to judge depth all the time. Okay? And the other thing would be, near things have a different texture than far things, on the average. Because we can't see the texture at greater distances. It washes out because our acuity isn't good enough. Okay, so we can use that also. All right, enough on depth perception. A little more, though, on navigation. Let's deal with homing pigeons. They have more ability to get home than those ants or people. Some dogs seem to do this, too. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows how. But we know a little more about homing pigeons. What do they use to direct their flight from hundreds of miles away? You take a homing pigeon, take it 200 miles away and release it. It finds its way back home. How does it do that? We don't know all the details, but there's a nice box there, page 84, 85, that discusses it. There's been a lot of interesting work on pigeons. So we do know some of the things they use, and some of it, the recent work, has been pretty surprising. One thing I didn't even know about, but this is a pretty recent book, which is one reason I chose it in spite of a few mistakes, and you know, it still has some pretty recent things in it, including this. How do they do it? Bridget?
They have a lot of things, like they can use the sun in their body clock.
Okay, she just named three ways they use it. Okay? If we just deal with how they fly off in the right direction when you release them, they've got to know the direction or they'll never get home. They have to know the approximate direction. They have to get in the vicinity of their home, their loft, where they can recognize the local cues. Remember the wasp? It flies up and can see the cues. Well, pigeons do that too. And they'll fly up and they spend a lot of time flying up looking around. They learn the visual landmarks, but that doesn't help them when they're 200 miles away. You know? So they need other ways initially. And it was studies of pigeons and some other animals have discovered that some animals have the ability to respond to the Earth's magnetic field. That's one thing. And they have cells with actually iron in them. They can show that they're responsive. It's produced a lot of arguments, a lot of controversy, but I think it's pretty well settled now that they really can use magnetic cues, not just pigeons, but other birds too. They're strongly affected by a magnetic pulse, some birds are, in their homing behavior or in their migration behavior. But here we're talking about something, it's an innate ability, but it involves learning too. They have to learn where they are. But they don't need the magnetic field. They'll still fly off in the right direction. How do they do it then? The clue comes when you realize that they use magnetic fields. They continue to fly well, even if it's cloudy. But when it's not cloudy, they'll tend to use the sun. Bridget mentioned they use the sun. They're actually using position, or correcting for its position with their biological clock. Okay? And then the most recent thing shows that they actually use olfaction as well. I think it's much less clear how they're doing that, but there is evidence that that's important also. Or it may be the olfactory sense is somehow also involved in their use of these other cues. That's not altogether clear to me. If any of you want to, that would actually make an interesting topic for a paper, if any of you were have a burning interest in the use of these cues and these abilities of animals. It does involve some controversy. But anyway, with close to the home, then if you do experiments like we talked about what Tinbergen did many years ago on the sand wasps, you can show that they use local landmarks to find their way back to their specific loft location. Can somebody, since you wrote on this, I want somebody to describe a Morris water maze. What does it look like? Somebody who has not said anything in the class today. Yes.
Huge circular metal container.
Well, not too huge. Maybe 8 feet across. It's not just any water. What kind of water do you have to put in? Think of the cues they have to use. You don't want them to use vision. And you can see through water if it's clear. So you've got to make it murky. You've got to make it dirty or milky or something so they can't see. What would they want to see? Sorry?
Platform.
They put a hidden platform. And initially the mouse or rat doesn't know where the platform is, but if he swims around rather frantically, he can swim, but he knows he can't swim forever, ever, and he finds out he can't climb those sides. But then, if he swims around enough, he finds the hidden platform and remembers where it is. Okay. So that's how the Morris water maze work. When you give them a later trial, they go much more quickly to the hidden platform because they remember where it is. Even though there's no obvious cues. So how do they discover what cues they use? Somebody else? Yes?
When you do the experiments, they would put the rat in a different place than the learning trials, and they found that they were still able to find the platform.
That's one thing. They could put them in from any place, and they'll still find it, right?
But when they moved the platform, even if they put the rats in at the same place that they were in during the learning trials, they weren't.
That's right. Unless you provide visual cues on the walls that they can use, they will have trouble if you move things around the room. The way you can do that is to, you can rotate the apparatus or rotate the environment if you can do that. But it's enough to just rotate the platform. And then, of course, you'd be changing the relative position of the hidden platform with respect to the room. And if they're using room cues, then you'll find out, and you can even cover the cues one by one, you'll find out which ones they're using. They might be using more than one. Okay? So how does it provide evidence for a cognitive map? Well, to remember, they had to have that map in their heads. They had to have a model in their heads. We call a map in this case, which we talked about before. So what do you need the hippocampus for? What does the pigeon needs a hippocampus for. Can the pigeon, the homing pigeon, still find his way home if you remove his hippocampus? Somebody says yes, somebody says no. You're actually both partially right, because they will fly off in the correct direction. They still remember the direction using magnetic and solar cues. But when they get in the vicinity of their loft, they don't seem to be able to remember. They just don't have that cognitive map anymore of the environment around their loft. They can't do that without a hippocampus. Now, whether they could do it with enough overlearning and everything else, it's possible. But we know it's severely disrupted by hippocampal damage. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about migration. The last topic, we were talking about navigation. Migration involves long-distance navigation at certain times of year, where mostly birds, but many other animals too, like elk, will migrate northward to have their babies and migrate back to feeding areas across Canada. Many birds fly, we know many songbirds fly to Central America or even South America, and then they'll come up to North America, the colder regions, to nest, to court, nest, have their, lay their eggs, have the babies, then they'll fly back to the south in the wintertime. So I want to know the benefits and the costs. Just summarize it for me. Why would they do that? Why do they fly such long distances? Why don't they just stay in one place? It's a heck of a lot easier. And yet these patterns of migration must have evolved as fixed action patterns in these animals for a good reason, for an adaptive reason.
Okay. Yeah. There might be a lot of food where they're trapped
inside. Okay. So why don't they just stay there where all the food is?
Where the food is fixed during the year.
Yeah, exactly. The food can be seasonal. Okay. So they might want to move just to get food at different times of year. There are other reasons too. They migrate to safer areas. Safer to have their babies. Now, these are a couple of good reasons, but there, it certainly comes at a cost too. What's the major cost? Incredible amount of energy it takes. And often they store up a lot of energy for these long flights, and they'll fly incredible periods without eating. And the same thing holds for the turtles. Mammals that do it, birds that do it, even insects do it. Give me one insect that we know migrates.
Butterflies,
like the monarch, is probably the most astounding story. How that little thing migrates these long distances always amazes me. But they do. Okay, just a little bit more about the cues. How could you get evidence? And this was, when I came into graduate school, this was still controversial. People thought it's an astonishing hypothesis that animals could use the configuration of stars. That means they have to be able to recognize constellations, in at least some sense, because they use the stars. But how could you discover that? How did they get evidence for that? When I visited Zeewezen many years ago, where Conor Lawrence had his division, and he studied his geese there, one of the people in his group, Herst Mittelstädt, had basically a, what do you call it, where you can display stars on the roof? A planetarium. He had a whole planetarium set up there. I remember inside he could also vary gravity. He could have animals living on a thing that was whirled around. It was quite incredible how he could control things. But I was interested in that planetarium. because he could display the night sky at any longitude or in any position on the earth. And he looked at, for example, the distance when animals came to that time of year when they were going to migrate. He would have them caged and they would get more and more restless. And then he would release them and see what direction they fly off in. And he found out it was pretty consistent. Okay. Well, how did you know they're not just using magnetic cues? Well, because he could rotate the planetarium around and it would fly off in a different direction depending on the stars. And we know that many birds do fly at night when they're migrating. Okay, that during the day they fly too, and then they don't use the stars, of course, then they have to use the sun or magnetic cues. And we know that they do both. But the amazing thing is that they can fly at night and use the stars. We've talked about other cues that they use. How do we know that it's innate? That's easy. They do it the first time, the first season. You can take birds that have never migrated before and they'll still fly off in the right direction. And if you take two different groups of the same species that live, or closely related species that live in different areas, and they fly in different directions in their migration, you will see in your planetarium they will fly in different directions. And one of those experiments is, they have some of the data, I believe, in the book.
Yeah.
Some birds don't migrate. But the ones that migrate, it's generally innate behavior. I think the question would be, do some of them, is learning playing a critical role? You know, that would be the question. I'm not sure. Does anybody know? The ones that have been studied, it seems to be innate, the direction they fly in. Okay. My guess is that they do learn details, and it's an interesting question. I can't recall it at the moment. Okay. I thought we would get started on the other, but it's too late. So the other thing that you saw me put on the web, this one we will start next time.